Most of the things that we can do to reduce the risk of developing dementia later in life are lifestyle, nutrition, and lifestyle.
Hi, welcome to Resonate, conversations and life lessons from Rancho La Puerta. I'm your host, Barry. One of the things I love about being at the ranch is the amazing food I get to eat. Most of it grown right here in our own organic garden. Our guests definitely get their daily dose of fruits and vegetables, and then some. We also serve dairy and fish. We continue to learn that lifestyle is important to our health and our longevity. We are identifying certain illnesses as being metabolic in nature, which means there's a chance we can avoid getting these diseases if we do what's right. Exercising, stimulating our minds, and eating a healthy organic diet all contribute to a healthy lifestyle. My guest today is Dr. Annie Fenn. Annie was a medical doctor for 20 years, and then her mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. She became very interested in nutrition and started to delve into nutrition and soon became a chef. Her latest book called The Brain Health Kitchen, Preventing Alzheimer's Through Food. She also founded The Brain Health Kitchen, a cooking school uniquely focused on cooking exclusively for your brain health. Eating for brain health is a hot topic these days, and I'm excited to learn more. Hey, Annie. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Barry. Thanks for having me. This is like the next best thing to actually being at the ranch.
Yes, for sure. And you're joining us from New Mexico today, which is fun, right? Because that's where I grew up, is in New Mexico. So.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, I did. Grew up there. So, Annie, you're an MD, right, who was a doctor for 20 years and an OBGYN, and your focus was on menopause later in your practice. Is that correct?
That's right.
And now you have something called Brain Health Kitchen, which you started in 2015. So tell us how you went from being an MD to becoming someone who's into brain health through food.
Well, you know, like most major life changes, like quitting your day job as a doctor, you know, to write about food and be a chef, there are a lot of things that went into it. But you have no idea how much my experiences at the ranch informed my decision. And I can get to that later.
That's exciting. It
really is. But basically, I had been working as an obstetrician gynecologist 20 years in my hometown of Jackson, Wyoming, where I still live. And, you know, I was delivering babies and I was doing lots of surgery and taking care of women. And I loved it. I loved every single minute of it. For the last 10 years of my practice, I focused on menopausal medicine. You know, back in a time when no one was really talking about that. And so I got women from all over the West coming to see me for menopausal consults. And I loved it. But 20 years in, I have to say, something was bothering me about being a doctor, working in traditional medicine. I felt like, number one, the lifestyle for me personally was very unhealthy. And I also felt like a lot of the problems that my patients came to me with, even traditional things like hot flashes and night sweats and, you know, some gynecological problems, I felt like the root cause was really their lifestyle and nutrition. And I just had this nagging idea that people need to eat better. People need to eat better. So I decided to retire, and I wanted to go to culinary school as a goal my entire life, just as being a passionate home cook. And that's what I did. I got some training. I came back into my town and started teaching healthy cooking, healthy Mexican, healthy Moroccan, healthy Mediterranean, healthy cooking on a budget, classes like that. And that's really how I started out. Now, a few years later, I started to pay attention to my medical journals. You know, once a doctor, always a doctor. We're always reading our journals. Right. And I started to see a lot of data come out looking at the link between what we eat and whether or not we get diagnosed with Alzheimer's or dementia later. So I took a couple of those early landmark studies around 2013, and I put it into a class. It was the first Brain Health Kitchen cooking class, and I collaborated with my local hospital. We did a dementia prevention program for our community. It was the first community-based dementia prevention program in the U.S. Now there's many, many of them. And around that same time, I'm teaching healthy cooking. I'm obsessing over the science about nutrition and how it affects your brain, especially long term. And then in that exact same year, my own mother was diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment, which turned out to be an early form of Alzheimer's.
So is dementia a form of Alzheimer's, or is it a prerequisite toward Alzheimer's?
So dementia is an umbrella term that that refers to age-related cognitive decline, of which there are many, many different reasons. Alzheimer's is the most common reason people get dementia. Alzheimer's makes up like 70%. That's why you hear so much about it. And also because Alzheimer's has particular, you know, sticky proteins that you can see in the brain with PET scans or in cerebral spinal fluid. You know, there's a lot of research about targeting a drug against Alzheimer's. But there's other causes. Parkinson's can lead to dementia. Vascular dementia, like having problems with the cardiovascular system, is another really common cause of dementia. And there are a handful of others.
And in 2022, I saw a study that said 1 out of 9 people at the age of 65 have Alzheimer's. And by the time you're 85, it's 50%. So 1 out of 2 people have it. So it seems like it's a super common thing.
And it's true. Dementia is becoming extremely common. And the number one reason for this is that people are getting older. There are more people now than ever before entering older age groups. And the biggest risk for getting Alzheimer's or another type of dementia is really getting older, which of course we all are. So we've got these large populations of people led by the baby boomer generation entering high-risk age groups like 60s, 70s, and 80s, high-risk for dementia. And that is the number one reason that we're seeing Alzheimer's rates go up in the U.S. and also around the world.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned earlier that it's there's proteins that attach to the brain, and that's what causes it. And is there a way to prevent those or get rid of those proteins once they are in the brain? Or is that upcoming research or upcoming science that we hope?
Well, you know, the latest thinking about Alzheimer's disease is that it is multifactorial. It's not just one thing. Mm-hmm. So think about the way we think about heart disease. Like if someone, you know, has a tragic cardiac event at the age of 50, like say some healthy person is out running and then has a heart attack at the age of 50. That person didn't just get heart disease. That person had been developing heart disease for decades, right? And now we know that Alzheimer's is the same way. And just like cardiovascular disease has many factors, it can be a sedentary lifestyle or too much stress or too much saturated fat in the diet and high cholesterol. It could be smoking. It could be all of these factors and a background genetic predisposition. It's really the exact same way with Alzheimer's. So the sticky proteins, which are amyloid and tau and a handful of other ones, no one really thinks that they're the cause of Alzheimer's, but they're probably the result of chronic inflammation that's been going on in the brain for up to 30 years before someone starts to show memory problems.
Wow. So is there a hereditary genetic factor that increases your risk?
There is a genetic factor, but it's not as much as people think. People tend to, I know this from being a physician for so many years, talking to women about breast cancer and such, people tend to overestimate the importance of their family history and their genetic predisposition to things. Okay. And with Alzheimer's, it's actually really less than 5% that's strongly, strongly genetic. Less than 5%. Most of the things that we can do to reduce the risk of developing dementia later in life are lifestyle, nutrition, and lifestyle, like exercise, not smoking, stress mitigation, good quality sleep, and of course, brain healthy eating is at the top of my list.
You talked about in your medical career, you worked in menopause with women, was one of your areas of expertise. And women are at higher risk for getting Alzheimer's than men. And does estrogen play a role in that?
I believe that it does. And this is a hot area of research right now, thankfully. When I was actually doing menopause work, we were all guessing about what was going on. Now we have actual, very solid data to show that for women, for some women, Alzheimer's actually begins, it takes root in the brain when that woman starts to go through perimenopause. So that's the earliest in a 7 to 10 year transition phase, which could start in her late 30s, her early 40s, her mid 40s. Perimenopause lasts on average 7 years. Menopause is when that transition phase is over. So at the very beginning of the perimenopause, a couple things happen. Number one, hormones fluctuate. Estrogen goes from super high levels to super low levels. So you've got this like erratic, you know, fluctuation in hormone levels. And that makes it really hard for the brain to access glucose. We all know that glucose is the primary fuel of the brain. Mm-hmm. So women get what has now been described as a bioenergetic crisis. And any woman who's gone through perimenopause will know exactly what I'm talking about. It's that feeling in the middle of the day, you could just lay down on your desk and go to sleep for no apparent reason. You're just, your brain just shuts down and turns off. It's because you can no longer access the glucose from food or from the glycogen that's stored in your body. Mm-hmm. And that is directly related to estrogen. Now, in this whole milieu of changing hormones, changing metabolic health of the brain, this is where amyloid protein can first start to seed in the brain and accumulate. Mm-hmm. And this is especially important for people that do have a genetic variant.
Do you think that women should supplement estrogen then during that phase in their life?
Well, there is a substantial argument for taking hormone therapy like estrogen and progestin, or just estrogen by itself, for women who are at high risk for Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's some really compelling data to suggest that. But the decision to take hormone therapy is, you know, it's a really individual one. Not everybody wants to take it. Not everybody should take it based on their medical factors. When it comes to the brain, we think that estrogen is neuroprotective. Now, this data is crazy, but the more estrogen that you've been exposed to in your life as a woman, be that from your own hormones, from your ovaries or whatnot, or from something you took like a birth control pill, like for 20 years when you were younger, the more estrogen you take, the less likely you are to get dementia later in life. Estrogen is neuroprotective on so many fronts.
So for a man, men have what we call menopause, right? Or men go through a change too. And like my doctor says, as men get older, they turn more into women. So I think that our testosterone levels tend to go down, our estrogen levels tend to go up. So would that be a protective thing for men then? Or would it have already started happening for men earlier in life? You said that sometimes it happens 30 years before the symptoms occur. So if you already have now I'm starting to have symptoms, is there things you can do that can slow it down a lot? Or, I don't think we can stop it, right? But we could slow it down. It can't be reversed, right?
Oh, absolutely. The name of the game with taking care of your brain is we don't know really how to prevent Alzheimer's. We don't know how to cure it. Mm-hmm. We don't really know exactly how to prevent it, like prevent someone from ever getting it. Mm-hmm. What we're doing is we're kicking the can of cognitive decline down decades, decades, and decades, so that like if you were to come down with dementia when you're maybe 105, you know, maybe it's not so tragic as when you're 65. So what we want to do is delay that brain aging, delay the aging of the brain for as long as possible. And that has been proven to be possible with lifestyle changes, especially nutrition.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk more, because is it a cookbook out for
eating? I do. It came out last year.
Yeah. And what's it called? Tell everyone it's called.
It's called The Brain Health Kitchen, Preventing Alzheimer's Through Food.
When I was reading through some of your stuff, it looks like it's the Mediterranean diet kind of is the baseline for it.
Exactly. So it's good for people to know that there's not one way to eat a brain healthy diet. Mm-hmm. There's actually many proven brain protective diets, but they're all based on the Mediterranean dietary pattern. That's where most of the data came out back when I was getting into this in like 2012. We had known for a long time that people that follow the Mediterranean dietary pattern, who live in the countries that surround the Mediterranean, they have less heart disease, right? They have less heart attack, they have less stroke, and they have some, you know, added advantage with longevity. And what some researchers started to key in on is that these people are not only living longer, they're living longer without dementia. So around 2000, 12, researchers started to look at these Mediterranean dietary patterns through the lens of brain health and started to do data just on that. And lo and behold, the Mediterranean diet was found to reduce dementia risk by as much as 20-25%. Now, in 2015, a landmark study came out of Rush University called the MIND Diet. Now, this is a spinoff of the Mediterranean diet. And the Rush researchers, they took the most brain healthy things out of the Mediterranean diet and made it its own thing. And then they followed people over 5 years to see who got more dementia based on how they adhered to this diet. And what they found was that the people that followed the MIND diet guidelines most faithfully, they were able to reduce the risk of being diagnosed with Alzheimer's by 53%. 53%.
That's amazing, actually.
It's amazing. This study is one of the things that propelled me to start Brain Health Kitchen as a cooking stool and decide to focus on this as, you know, my primary mission in combining medicine and culinary instruction.
And what is the Green Med diet?
Oh, I love the Green Med diet. This is a really popular one when I explain it to guests at the ranch. I teach at the cooking school, but I also give a couple talks during the week. Right. And I always talk about the Green Med diet. This, like the MIND diet, is a way of looking at the Mediterranean diet through the lens of brain health. It's more modern. It just came out a couple years ago. So in addition to following people to see if they get dementia, we have MRI data. They did MRI imaging of their brains initially and then 18 months later to see the rate at which the brain shrinks. Okay. That's probably about the best test you can get, you know, to see how your brain is doing as you age, to see if you're maintaining your brain volume over age. And the Green Med diet is basically the Mediterranean diet boosted with a couple things. Number one, walnuts. And like down to the number of walnuts, a handful of walnuts every day. Okay. On top of the Mediterranean diet. Two, green tea. Participants were asked to drink 4 to 5 cups of green tea a day.
Wow.
And the third one is to replace one meal a day that typically would have meat in it with a protein-rich green shake. And they used a special green called Mengkai, which you can't really get anywhere outside of Asia. But it's like a microgreen that's super high in protein. And they also asked participants to, you know, cut back on processed meat. Cut back on processed meat. And they gave everyone a gym pass. And so what they did is they compared people on the Mediterranean diet, people on the Green Med diet, and then a control group, which was sort of just a general healthy diet, looking at weight reduction. And what they found was that the most brain benefits were seen in the Green Med diet followers. And they were able to show this not only in total brain volume, but in the volume of the hippocampus. Now, that's the part of the brain that harbors the memory center. And that's the part of the brain that when it starts to shrink, you start to see symptoms of Alzheimer's, like cognition and memory problems.
Right. What is the benefit of walnuts and what is the benefit of green tea?
Polyphenols.
Okay.
Polyphenols. Yeah. Those are two of the most polyphenol rich foods. And believe me, I started drinking a lot more green tea after the Green Med diet came out.
Yeah,
I know. I was always a walnut fan, but
I know I need to like green tea more than I do.
Well, you know what I discovered about green tea? I'm a coffee drinker. So my approach to green tea was like making a cup of coffee. You know, I get a tea bag, I put hot water on it, I get it really strong. And then when I drink it, it doesn't taste good. It's bitter. Green tea, you have to be really gentle with. Like, you have to measure the temperature of the water. It shouldn't be a full boil because it burns the tea. And then any decent green tea will tell you on the package how many minutes to brew it. Okay. And it might just be 2 minutes. So I set my watch. And now I actually love green tea. I drink it every single day.
Wow. That's awesome. So what are some of the basic guidelines for Alzheimer's prevention diet? Like, lots of green leafy vegetables. Is it include fish? Does it include fruit? What are the grains that are good to eat?
Well, it's basically what, you know, Rancho Puerto serves its guests. I mean, Rancho Puerto has been serving a brain healthy diet for, you know, forever since I've been going there, you know, 27 years ago. But there are 10 brain healthy food groups that came out of this MIND diet study. right, that came out of the Mediterranean Dietary Study. But a really simple way for people to think about it is, you know, consuming foods from these food groups in the course of a week. Now we're talking about food groups, not superfoods.
All right.
Okay. So we're not talking about goji berries, but berries is its own food group.
Okay.
Yeah, so berries is one. Berries.
Yes, exactly.
Leafy greens.
Mm-hmm.
Vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
Nuts. Beans and legumes. Lord knows the ranch has that covered.
Yeah, for sure.
poultry, which you don't serve at the ranch.
We don't serve
it. Yeah, this is a kind of controversial one. We can come back to it if you like.
Okay.
Fish and seafood.
Is there any certain fishes that are better than others? Because I know now with tuna, the mercury thing is such a big thing.
Absolutely. There is a food pyramid in my book for each of these brain healthy food groups. My book is a cookbook, but each chapter is not based on like, you know, appetizers or desserts or main dishes. Mm-hmm. Each chapter is for the food group. So in the fish and seafood food group, there I've created this pyramid to show you what are the brain healthiest fish based on how potent it is in brain health nutrients like omega-3 fatty acids.
Okay.
Also how sustainable it is, which is really important.
Yes.
And whether or not it's going to give you too many neurotoxins like mercury. So the best way to remember the type of fish that are good for your brain is the acronym SMASH.
Okay.
SMASH is salmon.
Okay.
Preferably wild caught.
Okay.
Mackerel.
Mm-hmm.
A is for anchovies.
Okay.
I know. No. They can be so good. S is for sardines and then herring. But I tend to swap in halibut because I prefer it.
Okay.
So these fish are low in environmental toxins. They are high in DHA and EPA, which are crucial brain health omega-3 fatty acids. You can only get from food. You don't get it from anything else. Food and supplements, that's it. And they're also, you know, more sustainable for the planet, more planet friendly.
Okay,
the next one, whole grains, which you already brought up.
Right. Okay. And what whole grains, and not to interrupt you, but you know, I worry about that. And I also wonder about the fruits, because a lot of fruits have high glycemic indexes, right?
It's
so
true.
So people kind of avoid those sometimes.
And it's so true. You know, berries are the only fruit that's considered a brain healthy food group. Berries are special.
Okay.
It's not that other fruits are bad for you. I mean, there's certainly brain health nutrients in citrus fruits, and there's lycopene and carotenoids and things like watermelon and grapefruit. But berries are special because they have a certain brain health nutrient that goes straight to the brain and blocks oxidative stress. It's called anthocyanins. So berries is the only one that had like enough data behind it to be considered a brain healthy food group. And you're right. A lot of fruit has a, you know, a glycemic index that makes it maybe not so metabolically friendly.
Right. And when you're talking about grains, you're talking about whole grains, right?
I'm talking about whole grains. Right. So consider this, you know, 98% of the grains that Americans eat come from all purpose white flour and its derivatives. Things like bagels and flour tortillas and white bread and hamburger buns and hot dog buns and English muffins. The list goes on and on, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what most and how Americans mostly consume grains. We're not talking about that. We're talking about whole grains. Things like quinoa, which is actually a seed, but we consider it a grain. Barley, farro, all the rice, all the good whole grain rices, like forbidden rice, brown rice, red rice, all of those things. Oats. Oats is a whole grain. And all of these things can be processed to a point where they're no longer as nutrient dense. But these are some of the most affordable and delicious foods in our food system. If we can only like reach for them and know how to cook them.
Hi, my name is Lauren Boyle. I've been coming to Rancho La Puerta on and off for almost 40 years. I first came with my mom in 1985. I was a young mom then with school-aged kids, and my neighbors and friends and family made it possible for me to get away and push reset. Why do I keep coming back? Because Rancho La Puerta is life-changing, really. every time I come, I take home something that makes my life better. I learned to do Pilates here, and now I have a regular Pilates practice and my own reformer, and I've fixed my back problems. I learned to meditate here, and now we have a labyrinth in our on our family cattle ranch. I learned to write here. I took the best writing workshops and learned to write short stories and poetry, and I was able to self-publish a book during COVID. I took great photography classes here that have made my travel photography so much better. And I took an amazing class called Your Next Calling, How to Do the Thing You Don't Think You Can Do. And as a result of that class, I am now a harpist. But I think the thing that is the greatest is the people and the camaraderie and the companionship here. You always feel at home, and you always meet people that teach you things about yourself, that help you be a better person. And then there's the spa treatments, and I just came from happy hands and feet, and I have very happy hands and very happy feet and a very happy heart. Rancho La Puerta's motto is siempre mejor, always better. And I always come home a better person. Gracias, Rancho La Puerta.
I hope you are enjoying today's podcast as much as I am. To learn more about our wonderful presenters and exciting weeks coming up at the ranch, go to rancholaporta.com and check out our events calendar. Make sure to mention the podcast when making your reservation to take advantage of a special offer. Some restrictions may apply. It seems like eating that kind of a diet is not only good just for your brain, but it's good for your whole system, your whole body.
It's so true. You right. know, when I was a doctor talking to patients about what they should eat for their general mm-hmm. health, I mean, I swear for decades, it would just go in one ear and out the other. Mm-hmm. When I started talking about brain health, people really started to listen, because I think that we all harbor a fear that maybe someday we would lose our, you know, our best asset, which is our mind. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone has that fear, especially if you've seen someone go through it, or you've had someone in your family suffer from dementia. So people are afraid of getting dementia, and I don't want to play on that fear because, you know, mm-hmm. the rates are going up. We need to be, you know, hyper aware of all this and do what we mm-hmm. can do to protect our brains. But I think that thinking about it in terms of brain health, it's like a top-down effect. You take care of your brain, then mm-hmm. you've got your cardiovascular system covered. Okay, there's right. a huge overlap between brain health and heart health. You're taking a lot of anti-cancer preventive medicine. You know, all of these foods that we're talking about have been shown in other data to prevent mm-hmm. the risk of cancer, and also improve longevity in general by staying fit and strong and healthy as you age.
Right. And I know that when we talked about different genes can make you more predispositioned, and now there's so many, even at my doctor's office, they will do a for an extra fee, they'll do a genetic test and tell you what you're predisposed to. So, mm-hmm. but the epigenetics is now telling us that is telling us now that, you know, your lifestyle can maybe turn off or turn on genes, or has a bigger effect than we ever thought it did before. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to like give up because you have a gene that predispositions you to something.
It's true. And this gets really confusing with Alzheimer's, because there are basically two categories of these genes. Mm-hmm. One is responsible for early onset Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. And this happens in 1% of Alzheimer's patients. Okay. Very, very rare. But it's the tragic story that was depicted in Still Alice, the movie, mm-hmm. of the Columbia professor who's 50, and she comes, you know, she gets diagnosed with Alzheimer's. She has this autosomal dominant trait that gets passed down to half of her children. So that is a very rare condition that most people are kind of aware of. You know, there's a family in Colombia where they start to get Alzheimer's in their 30s. This is not the typical thing that we're talking about here. The other genetic variant that you can get checked at your doctor's office very commonly is called APOE4.
Right.
Okay. Now, this is something that 20 to 25% of all Americans actually have one or two copies. So it's very common, and yet the impact depends on epigenetics, your lifestyle. Your lifestyle can turn this APOE4 gene off, or it can accelerate the damage that it potentially can do.
Got it. Yeah. So when we're talking about lifestyle, you did mention, you know, not only what you eat, but sleep is really important. Mm-hmm. And how many hours of sleep would you recommend a person have?
7 to 9.
Yeah.
7 to 9 hours. I used to be one of those people who said, oh, I don't need to get 8 hours of sleep. Mm-hmm. You know, as an OB resident or as a doctor, I would stay up all night working and work the whole mm-hmm. next day. Right. I thought I was impervious to it. But no one is impervious to the need for sleep. While we sleep, our brain goes into all of these metabolic cleanup functions, mm-hmm. one of which is clearing out these sticky proteins like amyloid and tau from the brain. So if you don't give your brain time to go into deep sleep and go through like all those REM and deep sleep cycles that we know are healthy, then you're less likely to have this cleanup benefit. It's very important.
I feel like as people get older, I know for me too, it's so much harder to sleep. I feel like I wake up all the time, have our time going back to sleep. So it is.
Yeah, we become more vulnerable to, you know, the things that we eat and drink during the day. Stress has a huge impact. People become really light sleepers. So it's a challenge. You have to prioritize sleep and prioritize your sleep routine as you get older.
Right. And you also mentioned exercise. Or movement. Mm-hmm. Is there any particular types of movement that are better than others? Like is it weightlifting? Is it cardio? Is it stretching and yoga? Or is it just making sure you're active every day?
Yes and no. I mean, I believe that exercise is just as important as a brain healthy diet. Like mm-hmm. I look at them as 50-50. They're like the seats of a stool. Okay.
Okay.
That is your foundation for taking care of your brain as you get older. And both cardiovascular exercise and strength training exercise have been found to be equally important in terms of the things it does for your brain, like turning on BDNF, you know, brain derived neurotrophic factor, mm-hmm. which helps with our neuroplasticity, or cleaning up amyloid protein, or having a healthy cardiovascular, plexus of blood vessels mm-hmm. to supply the brain so that, you know, when you're 80 years old, you have robust blood flow to the brain. Right. All of those things come from exercise. I truly believe that strength training is mandatory for all people, especially mm-hmm. women, but all people, mm-hmm. as a way to combat dementia.
Are there certain cognitive exercises that people should be doing? You know, there's some research out showing now that if you are moving when you're learning a new task, that's really good for your brain. Like, say, trying to learn a new language while I'm walking or exercising. The combination of those two things is really important for our brains.
It is too. It helps strengthen your memory. Like I'm learning Italian, so I try to run through vocabulary lists or watch movies in Italian while I'm on a spin bike, you know, for example. That data is real. So what we're talking about is cognitive reserve. Cognitive reserve is a really important concept for protecting the brain. It means that you are constantly stretching your brain, doing things that are intellectually challenging. It doesn't mean doing easy crossword puzzles over and over, doing Sudoku, just doing like easy games. That's a fallacy that people get into. For cognitive reserve to actually change the neuroplasticity of your brain, it has to be difficult. It has to be something like learning an instrument, learning a new language, navigating a new place. That's why travel is so good for your brain.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things have been shown to like build collateral pathways in your brain. So that if you were to accumulate damage from these proteins or inflammation over time, then you just got plenty of reserve.
Well, that's super interesting. Now, I think you mentioned, or maybe I just read people that live in the blue zones, and that's a really big thing now, the blue zones. And most of them do eat like a healthy diet, the Mediterranean kind of diet. But I also noticed that I think all but one of those blue zones, they do drink wine.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the, I know everyone I know drinks wine, so including myself. So is wine, like not good for your brain?
Well, we should talk about that. We didn't get to the last two
groups. Let's talk about that. Yeah,
that's okay. One was extra virgin olive oil.
What makes virgin olive oil extra virgin?
It's basically a grade of quality. So okay. Humans should only consume extra virgin olive oil. Everything else is an inferior grade used in industry or for other purposes.
And do you think a tablespoon a day is enough?
Well, in Mediterranean cultures, the typical consumption is a quarter cup a day.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. In the U.S., it's, you know, Americans consume probably like 2 teaspoons at best.
Okay.
Every time you swap in extra virgin olive oil for another fat that is a saturated fat, such as butter or, say, mayonnaise, which I don't really recommend, or a dairy fat, okay? So if you do a one-to-one swap, 2.5 teaspoons of olive oil for one of these other fats, you reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease, cancer, and getting one of these neurodegenerative diseases by between 17 and 29%. It's dramatic, this one little fat swap.
That's amazing.
And think about the Mediterranean people. They are not only cooking with extra virgin olive oil, and the olive oil that they get is really fresh. It's very high in polyphenols, which is good for your brain. But they're also drizzling it on their food. So it's like the secret sauce of the Mediterranean diet. Not only does it have nutrition in its own right, like monounsaturated fats, polyphenols, but it also is a conduit to absorbing all these plant foods that make up the diet.
What if you eat olives?
I love that. I added olives as a bonus food group in my book. I changed the brain healthy food groups a little bit based on some data that was more updated. Mm-hmm. But I added olives because olives give you all of the same benefits of olive oil with the fiber.
No, that's great. That's good.
So, and there's lots of studies that show that if you consume olives before a meal, it helps regulate blood sugar after the meal. It's like having like a good high fiber boost going into a meal. Actually, it makes it more, blood sugar friendly.
So what was the final food group that you mentioned?
The 10th brain healthy food group is the most controversial. It's red wine.
Okay.
So look at the Mediterranean diet studies, over decades. Red wine is a part of the culture. Red wine is consumed at the table amongst family and friends. You have to remember the Mediterranean diet is not just a diet, it's a lifestyle. It has to do with how you consume your food, what you do after you eat. You go for a long walk, what you do at the table. You linger, you laugh, you tell stories, you share wine, things like that. That's how the red wine became a brain healthy food group. Plus, in the past, it was always considered to be something that's very high in polyphenols, right? Like a good source of polyphenols for your diet. Right?
But it's only red wine, right?
Yes, because of the skin contact of the grapes. These polyphenols, these flavonoids that are really good for your brain, they tend to be in the skin or the peel of fruits, like grapes or berries. Grapes, actually a berry. So then there was the MIND diet, right? They, as a nod to the Mediterranean diet, they included red wine as a brain healthy food group with this caveat, no more than 5 ounces a day. Do you know how big of a glass of wine that is?
I do. It's not too big.
When I started giving brain health kitchen cooking classes, like back in 2015, I used to take a Sharpie on a wine glass and show people how much wine that actually is. It's a very small glass of wine.
Yeah.
It's a very small glass of wine. Okay. And I have spent a lot of time in these blue zones. I've spent time in Sardinia, and I've spent time in parts of rural Sicily. There are unknown blue zones, not really famous blue zones, but they have packs of centenarians. And my observation is that people are drinking wine daily with friends, but they're not drinking large amounts. They're drinking their wine out of like these little juice glasses. And they're one and done. They go and meet their friends. They laugh. They might even smoke. They laugh. They hang out. They have their juice glass of wine. And then they go home and have minestrone soup with their family. That's my observation of how drinking happens in blue zones.
In the blue zones, do they have a less amount of Alzheimer's?
They do. They do. The centenarians tend to be dementia-free.
Wow.
I've spent over a month in Sardinia this past year, and I met a lot of the healthy elders and a lot of the people in communities. And when you talk to someone, say, in their 60s or 70s or 80s, I would ask, so how many people do you know have memory problems? They're like, we don't know anyone with memory problems. Or do you know anyone with Alzheimer's? And it's honestly Right. It's rare in these countries.
The Blue Zones is a big thing right now. Everyone's talking about the Blue Zones. So,
yeah, the Blue Zones are amazing. And actually going to Sardinia and visiting these towns is something I highly recommend. I take groups there. It's eye-opening to see all of the culture, not just taking pieces out of it. So getting back to the red wine, when I was writing my book, I'm a red wine drinker. You know, I enjoy all things food, including sharing wine with food. And I was going to include red wine as one of the brain healthy food groups in my book. Okay. Mm-hmm. But a major study came out. This was 2021, right when my manuscript was about to go to my editor for the final version. And this was a study of 36,000 participants in the UK. Okay. Mm-hmm. Looking at how their brain shrinks over time. So this is 36,000 MRIs done serially over time. And they looked at, okay, so if you're a moderate drinker, how much does your brain shrink over time compared to if you're a light drinker or a heavy drinker or a non-drinker? And we've had data for all of these things before, but it's always been just murky, right? Like the non-drinkers, that whole category that's been studied is always complicated by the fact that some of those non-drinkers are former drinkers, like former problem drinkers that quit.
Right.
So you just don't know what to think of that, right? Mm-hmm. People have different definitions of moderate drinking. The actual definition by the CDC is one drink a day for women, two drinks a day for men. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the surprising finding of this study was that level of moderate drinking actually shrinks the brain at a faster rate over time than light drinking or not drinking. Mm-hmm. And heavy drinking, of course, was, you know, detrimental to brain health. So we just had to reset our thinking about, well, there's all this folklore and sort of urban legend about how alcohol is good for the heart, it's good for the brain. When you actually look at MRI data, it tells you a completely different story.
Right.
So I encourage people to just reel in, you know, their alcohol intake. I still drink red wine. It's my preferred beverage, but I'm not drinking 7 drinks a week. That would be moderate drinking. Where they started to see a neutral pattern was between 1 and 4 drinks a week. And I think that's a good guideline for a lot of people, especially women who are also at higher risk for Alzheimer's and cannot metabolize alcohol the same way.
Right. I know that there's some of the different groups that are also at a higher risk. For example, African Americans and Latin. And do you think that's... Is that related to the access to healthy food?
Oh, I think it's so much about access to healthy food. And the other thing is medical care. There was one paper that I wrote about in my newsletter last year that was just so telling. So the African-American community has about 1.5 greater risk of developing Alzheimer's than, say, a white Caucasian American.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But if you address cardiovascular risk factors like high blood pressure, mm-hmm. and you treated these aggressively at midlife, between the ages of 45 and 65, mm-hmm. you could reduce that risk back down to that of an Caucasian American. So a lot of the reasons we're seeing more Alzheimer's in that population may be from cardiovascular risk factors, which of course have to do with access to healthy food, addressing simple medical things like blood pressure and cholesterol, right? And exercise. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's low hanging fruit in the Alzheimer's prevention world, but it's not so simple to tackle in a public health
That's front. So true. Well, gee, I don't want to take up any more of your time. So I really appreciate you spending this time with me. And you you're a guest chef here at the ranch and you're also a guest presenter. So will you be back in 2025?
Yes, I'll be back in June. We're actually going to be putting together a brain health focused week. I have some other brain health experts coming in, and I'll also have a brain health kitchen group. I did that last month when I was there, and that was really fun. So it's like a retreat within the ranch of people that come to do extra activities with me. Like we had a green tea tasting, and we had a chocolate tasting. So we did some fun things like that. And I come every spring and every fall to the ranch, and I have since 2015.
That's wonderful. So, and if our listeners are interested, if you go to our website on the events calendar, you'll see when Annie will be at the ranch next. And I hope you have a wonderful year until I see you again.
Thank you. You as well. Take care of your brain.
I'm going to take care of my brain. Yes, I'm going to try to cut down on my wine.
I know. It's easy to say, but sometimes it's hard to do.
Yes. Well, thank you
so much. It helps with sleep. Helps with your sleep.
Yeah, I've heard that too. So, yeah.
Thanks for having me.
No, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
I was happy to hear that what I've been eating here at the ranch for the past 20 plus years has been good for my brain. Turns out the Mediterranean diet that we serve here at the ranch checks most of the boxes for brain health. Epigenetics is on the forefront of research these days, and it's starting to show us that if we take care of ourselves, many of the diseases that people get could be avoided. For me personally, I learned that green tea is good for my brain, and I might start to have a few less cups of coffee and replace that with some green tea. Also, a handful of walnuts every day feeds your brain, as well as 1 tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil. Sadly, it turns out alcohol is not a friend of your brain health. Definitely moderation is needed when it comes to alcohol. Maybe there are a few things you can change in your life. I know I'm going to adjust a few things in my life as well. Wishing you health, daily joy, and a powerful brain.